You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation here at the Brookings Institution. And I'd like to welcome you to this forum on how social media is changing government and governance. Today is an eventful time in the history of human civilization. We've seen the rise of social media and it's the role that it's playing in political protest in many nations around the world. It's played a role in Egypt, Tunisia, Spain, Greece, and most recently in Turkey, among other places. So citizens, businesses, journalists, and government officials are trying to figure out how to use social media and what its impact has been in these protests, as well as in the more general relationship between citizens and government. Because this is a time of unprecedented social media use, it's important to try and analyze how social media are changing political communications and what its impact is on the interaction between governments and citizens. So we have set up a Twitter feed with the hashtag TechCTI. That's TechCTI. So any of you who wish to post comments or ask questions, feel free to do so. We have two very distinguished experts to help us think about the role of social media. Farouk Eksasabasi, I probably mispronounced that.
That's not good at
all. Is chairman of the Turkish Informatics Foundation. This is an organization that was founded in 1995 to assist Turkey and help it make its transformation to an information society. In that role, he has helped prepare various research reports and contributed to the shaping of public policy in the information area. He currently serves as vice chairman of his company. He's been instrumental in the group's e-transformation as head of the company's information and communications technology division. He serves on the e-transformation executive board, and they helped to establish the action plan in Turkey for electronic government. He also helped to establish with the Turkish Business and Industry Association Turkey's first and only private sector award for the public sector. His latest involvement with the Informatics Foundation has been to organize a Knowledge Economy Institute, which researches and offers ways to help inject competitiveness into the Turkey economy through innovation. Zeynep Tufekci is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina. She has appointments in the School of Information as well as the Department of Sociology. Her research revolves around social, political, and cultural impacts of technology. She is especially interested in social movements around the world, civics, and the use of technology in the public sphere. In addition to her academic writing, she blogs at technosociology.org on how technology and society interacts. And she also is a fellow at Princeton University at its Center for Information Technology Policy and is a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. So I'm going to start with Farouk. And I do want to point out, this is his first visit back to Washington, D.C. in 25 years when he and his new wife celebrated their honeymoon. So welcome back to Washington, D.C. Talk about a great way to celebrate your 25th wedding anniversary. We've seen social media used in protests around the world, and we know it certainly has played a very active role in the Gezi Park protests in Turkey. So I'm just curious about these young activists, how they're using social media and how that is affecting the relationship between government and citizens.
Thanks. Thanks, sir. First of all, really, thank you very much to give me the opportunity to be together with such a distinguished audience here. And I would like to start with a personal experience. On April 29, it was a Monday, and the governor of Istanbul got together a group of people, stakeholders, mainly NGOs, academicians, business from people from the business community, artists, journalists, to talk about the future of Istanbul, how to make Istanbul kind of a brand. And At the very beginning, when everybody was bringing their ideas to the table, my introduction were based on the words of Richard Florida. And he said in his book, I think it was The Creative Cities or Rays of Creativity, something like this. And he mentioned the three T's for increasing the innovation of the regions. He mentioned the three T's. The first T was technology. And technology is something you can get the best technology money can buy always. Second was the talent. And in an environment, in a city or in a metropole, whatever you call it, the average talent is not more and not less than anywhere else. And so the same goes for Istanbul. And the third one was tolerance. And I said, this is where the problem is. And we had to show, we have to give the perception to the world that Istanbul is a tolerant city. People live together and people like to live together, of different identities, different minorities. People from all over the world, not only tourists, should be expected. This is the perception what is necessary we should give to the rest of the world. That was the 29th of April. Three days later, there was the 1st of May, and there were the riots, and the police acted, to be honest, not in the very tolerant way. And a month later, the Gezi Park issue started, and the rest was history. And it all started at the 30th of May, and against the expectations, a big young population in Istanbul, they went to Gezi Park just to support the environmental groups of who were already in the park before. And they reacted in a very different way, very unexpected way. They dominantly used the social media just to gather together and just to lead their friends or their colleagues to take the necessary steps to come to the Gezi place. And that was very strange for the governing people, for the government or for the municipality, and they for a certain while, for a couple of days, they just didn't know what to do. They were, in a way, speechless. They were not speechless, and unfortunately, the government in general started to act in a quite aggressive way. And there you got the notion that governments in general, or the people who are at the establishment, who are at the management level, they are really not in a position how to judge the young generation, how they should act to the expectations and the demands of the young generation. Plus, they didn't even know what kind of tools they had in their hands. I think that was the biggest lesson at that time, in the beginning of June and July, the aggressiveness of the government, the tools the young generations used, And the discrepancy between those two issues, this was the first big surprise in Istanbul, in Turkey, about the Gezi issues. The lessons I think we should take out of it, first of all, this is not only valid in Turkey. This is valid, I mean, Zeynep Hanım knows it much better than I do. She observed the whole thing in Egypt too. And even though we see those problems for the time being only in the Middle East area, may it Arab Spring, whatever you call it, Tahrir or Gezi Park, this or in Brazil, this will change, in my opinion, from the emerging countries to also to the rest of the world, unless the established management system all over the world learns how to deal with the dynamic tools of the young generation, how to react to them, and how to answer them.
Okay. Zeynep, so as was just mentioned, you interviewed hundreds of the activists in Gezi Park. You also have talked with activists in the United States and in other places where these kinds of protests have unfolded. What have they told you about their reasons for being upset and then their use of social media in the political protest?
Again, thank you for inviting me to this event. So Gezi was just one more movement I studied. I am originally from Turkey, so that was fortuitous. But I had previously studied the Arab Spring uprisings. I had traveled to Egypt, Tunisia, elsewhere in the region, and I have published on Occupy. And also, I should say, there were similar movements in Spain, M15. There's a movement in Greece that looked like that. And before Gezi, I had been studying these other movements and how my particular area is how the new technologies are changing movement dynamics. And I was starting to think that even though there were different places, I mean, Occupy New York, really different kind of environment than, say, Tahrir, Egypt, with its crumbling autocracy, or, you know, Spain, I had been thinking there were certain similarities in the way these movements were playing out. You know, there was the generational factor, the social media use factor, this kind of boom-bust cycle. And after Gezi happened, and I basically jumped on a plane and went back to do my interviews and my research there, I'm increasingly convinced that there are broad similarities in the movements. In the Gezi interviews I did with the people who were the core participants, the people who had showed up and, you know, with their tents and occupied the park, there's this growing disillusionment with just rulers and governance. There's this, and I find this in Occupy youth, I find this in Spain. There is increasingly lack of trust, lack of expectation. There's a deep crisis of representation. They don't feel represented. In different countries, there's, you know, we know the problems, huge youth unemployment. In Europe, it's incredible, you know, through the roof. Here, it's really not good either. It's not as bad, but it's still so bad that by itself it should be a crisis. On the other hand, even though they're increasingly disillusioned with existing institutions, thanks to social media, they really have it pretty easy compared to previous generations in terms of finding each other and finding their voice. So what happened in the case of Istanbul protests was, if you follow the news a bit, there's a park. It was going to be razed, then Ottoman barrack replica was going to be put in its place. You're going to say, what are you going to do with an Ottoman barrack replica in the middle of Taksim if you've been there? Well, nothing. They were going to make it into a shopping mall, apparently, and high-scale, upscale hotels, which wasn't a popular plan. And there was just sort of this back and forth over the park and the trees. So it started as a pretty small thing. You know, there were a few dozen people who were trying to protect the trees when it began. But what happened was, when those few dozen people were met with tear gas and their tents were burned, unlike, say, maybe 10 years ago when that just would have been it. They went on social media and started saying, look, this is happening. They're burning our tests. They're tear gassing us. And there were very dramatic pictures that started coming out of these few dozen people. And as people heard of this on social media, they started coming. This is a very central location. So they started coming to this place to check it out. And in my interviews, this is sort of the procession of fans. This is what people told me. So I heard of this happening in Taksim, and I thought, you know, this shopping mall barrack was a bad idea anyway. And then I heard, like, these pictures, I saw these pictures of people getting tear gassed. It's a really easy place to get to, center of Istanbul. So I went there, and then I got tear gassed myself. This is what they told me. And then I got really upset. Why am I being tear gassed? I just showed up here. And then I took pictures of what was happening. And then I sent it to all my friends on social media. And then, you know, the person next to them would then turn to me and say, and that's when I came over, right? So there was this sort of really strong network. Now, strikingly, at the same time, to make things worse for sort of the environment, Turkish televisions, which are increasingly owned by pretty large conglomerates who also do business with the government, were exercising in this pretty spectacular form of self-censorship. So after maybe 24 to 48 hours, there were multi-day clashes between protesters and police in the middle of the biggest central square in Istanbul, perhaps. And the televisions, the sort of main televisions, were showing things like cooking shows. If you turned on CNN International, they were live from Taksim. If you turned on CNN Turkey, you got a penguin documentary at the same time. So somebody put his two television screens side by side, turned one to CNN Turkey, turned one to CNN International, and just put that on Twitter. That became viral. That was sort of this really, because people just couldn't believe it, that something like this could be happening and it wouldn't even be news on television. Not believing it, more people showed up to say, is this really happening? So the penguin documentary became, penguins became the symbol for many people. And this was a humor magazine, which was incidentally called Penguin, but that was a coincidence, started giving out these Bansky-inspired penguins throwing flowers. So people got really upset, they told me in the interviews, at the media's lack of showing this. Now, I had the same experience in my interviews and surveys in Egypt, where people said when Mubarak unplugged the internet, it did two things. It really angered whoever wasn't already very, very angry, because they were like, we can't live in a world. People expect to be informed. It's not, you know, it's the public sphere has been transformed. So the idea that the televisions would show penguin documentaries at the same time, it didn't, I mean, I think even unsympathetic coverage wouldn't have angered people this much. The fact that it wasn't on at all. So in Egypt, when Mubarak unplugged the internet, people got angry. The other thing that happened was a lot of people's kids were in Tahrir, and they were checking on them. Remember, cell phones got unplugged too in Egypt. They were checking on them with cell phones and, you know, with SMS and with internet. So parents got really worried, and they went to Tahrir too to check on their kids because they knew where to go. So, in fact, unplugging the internet probably made things for the Egyptian regime. I think in this case, the TV censorship made things really worse for the governance issue, because people got upset and went to the square to see what was happening. So that came out in my interviews. The third thing that came out was that it became a symbol. After the tear gas and after the media censorship, a lot of people started seeing this as, wait, we have to sort of at least make our voice heard that we exist. They, you know, whatever concerns they had over the government's position in Turkey, and you have to realize this is a polarized country. This is not Egypt. This is a polarized country. Well, Egypt is a very polarized country now, but when the Tahrir early protests were going on, you know, the country was pretty united against, you know, getting Mubarak out. In the case of Turkey, it's polarized. There's strong support on both for and against the government. So people wanted to sort of have their voice heard. Now, in terms of the other protests and these similarities, what I'm increasingly seeing is these network movements, which know how to the social media was the capillary of this movement. They coordinated everything through mostly Twitter, a little bit of Facebook, because Twitter is lightweight and it's on your phone. And Turkey is a wired country. It's not that poor a country. You know, people have cell phones, people have smartphones, especially in Istanbul. So these network movements are used to constant information, a lot of strong logistics that would have been very difficult just 5-10 years ago are quite easy. In the case of Egypt, I watched 4 young people, all in their early 20s, coordinate 10 field hospitals through enormous clashes in Mohammed Mahmoud Street. We're in the anniversary of where 33 people died. This wasn't a minor thing. 10 field hospitals, thousands of injuries, dead people. So these are doctors and nurses just doing, working at these, and their supplies are necessary, and you need to move patients around. And you need to sort of do this enormous logistical undertaking. They just did it using social media and Google Docs and Excel spreadsheets. And you know, after it was all over, they had like, you know, they knew how many needles were in which field hospital. After all this was over, I interviewed these 4 youngsters. And I said, where'd you get the idea? And they said, well, a cupcake store they knew was good at social media ads, so they thought they could just do the same thing. And I said, great, I'm really glad you haven't read history. You know, I'm really glad you don't know anything about Napoleon or Hitler and Moscow and logistics, because this kind of, you know, I saw this in Gezi, this kind of logistics becoming easy is a hallmark, shaping the narrative is a hallmark. But finally, I think another thing that's the hallmark of these movements is a boom-bust cycle. We saw this in Occupy, we saw this in M15, we saw this in Gezi somewhat. And the boom-bust cycle, I'm increasingly thinking, is because since the logistics are so much easier, since you don't need to have, you know, this was their leaderless. They don't really need leaders. They can sidestep a lot of infrastructure and organizational issues because social media allows them to sidestep. But in some ways, I'm increasingly likening to, you know, Sherpas carry your bags to base camp in Everest. Great, you're there. But you're not really a mountain climber. You haven't really built the muscles necessary to do the next things. And eventually, you're going to have to climb the rest of the mountain, and you're not prepared for it because you had so much help. And I think a lot of these movements, because the logistics and infrastructure have become so much easier, are able to do things that no longer signal. You know, there's a loud bark, but it doesn't signal the same sharp teeth you would have thought, say, 5-10 years ago. And then you see this bust cycle where the movement cannot translate into classic social movement trajectories of, you know, electoral outcomes. And this is partly a function of the more left-wing movements, because there's also issues of being leaderless is culturally more resonant. Whereas you're seeing, especially in Europe, right-wing parties, I think, are used, like grassroots movements are more electorally oriented. To a degree in the U.S., too, Tea Parties, you know, very, it uses social media a lot similarly. So you're seeing this bust cycle in terms of movements not really having the same impacts, although I do think they're having huge biographical impacts. People, large numbers of people have participated in these protests. And this comes out in my interviews. Their lives are changed, and this is a very big deal for them. This is sort of a defining moment in their short lives, and they're equipped with a lot of tools to do other things. So it'll be really interesting to see how this generation plays out over the next 5-10 years in this climate of both empowerment and a crisis in governance, I would say, globally.
Okay, thank you. So each of you mentioned several positive aspects of social media in various countries around the world in terms of its ability to help mobilize activists, the vehicle in terms of getting your voices out. But in terms of the limits of social media, I mean, when you look at some of the cases, like in Egypt, the military is running things. In Turkey, the government still is in operation. And you know, you talked about the boom and bust cycle here. Is the real lesson here is that social media can create a lot of noise, but its ability to actually produce meaningful political change is actually quite limited. Rook, we'll start with you.
Zeynep is mentioning about the boom and bust cycle. I would rather say the hype cycle. I mean, there's a first wave of hype, which will, we'll see in almost all kind of new, also business ways. People are adapting themselves to a first coming new breakthrough business idea, and then after a while it drops down pretty fast, and then it slowly shows his head upwards and goes more in a more stabilized way. People are more adapting themselves more seriously. This is, I would rather take this example than the boom and bust cycle. Yes, that's true. I just want to, if I try to make an prediction in my sense, I would say there will be a boom, there will be a bust, but when those youngsters start to get into a productive life, when they get their jobs, when they find their way in their own established life, they will be using their own tools in a different way. Not in the way what we are doing it, because we are calling ourselves the digital immigrants. In my opinion, all the generations from now on, they all be digital immigrants. But the behavior they are showing, they will be much more adaptable for new changes. And they will use them more effectively in their business life, in their private life, in their social life, and most probably in the also in the political life. For the time being, I don't see any indicators in general that the new media, Twitter, or Facebook, or whatever social media we are talking about, they are not used in a more productive institutional way yet. But as Michael Spence says, I mean, that it is not used yet, that doesn't mean that it will not be. And I think this is the turning point of our civilization right now. This will be the major change in the next probably decade.
Okay, Zainab, so he says boom, bust, but long-term transformation. What do you think about that?
I would completely agree with the long-term transformation. You know, by the boom, bust, I mean the movements we're studying and sort of how they're deflating. Now, I want to give an example from the printing press. When the printing press first sort of was invented, the Catholic Church, that at the time was handwriting indulgences that it was selling, if you know the history. The indulgences allowed people to spend less time at the purgatory and were being sold for gold. So it had become a pretty corrupt practice, let's say. But they were having difficulty writing enough indulgences to sell. So that when the printing press came about, the Catholic Church thought, great, we can print a lot more indulgences. What a great invention for us. Well, that was the first, 10, 20 years. If you look at it historically, it also allowed the translation of the Bible to the vernacular, and then which created people with new ideas about their religion, which then disempowered sort of the priestly function of interpreting the Bible because people could then see it, and then the rest is history, right? We have the sort of the whole Reformation and everything. So if you looked at the printing press right after it was invented and you thought, oh, this is going to be great for the Catholic Church, you would have been right and very wrong, right? Because these things don't play out the same way in the long term as they necessarily do in the short term. So when I look at this, I absolutely cannot see how it's not going to have a huge impact in the long run. I do think, though, that the impact might not be some of the ways that we think it's going to have. One of the things that you see a lot in the literature on, sort of the academic literature and sort of the similar policy studies, is how the lower coordination costs for social media are making things easier for social movements, you know. And I think it's kind of a wrong way to look at it. I don't know if he's in the audience. A colleague of mine, well, a friend of mine, Dave Karp, who was in the RSVP list, I don't know if he made it in this weather, has written this book called The Move-On Effect that looks at how institutional NGOs have been transformed by social media. And one of the things he noticed was that, you know, the petition by going to door was dead because you can just do it online. And it looks like, oh, lower coordination costs. Isn't that great? This is just wonderful. But actually, going door to door for the petition had a lot of benefits because it allowed you to talk to people and recruit them in a way that you don't do online. So it's actually not necessarily a good thing. I think this is true for social media. Some of its affordances, some of the things it enables that look great, aren't necessarily what's going to have the impact. But there are certain things it allows that I believe are going to have a huge impact. One of them that we're seeing in social movements across the world is it allows people to find people like each other, like homophily, very easily, which is the core requirement to have a movement. If you're just yourself, you're not going to really going to speak up and do much. But from everyone who, you know, people from upset at Mubarak's regime in Egypt to the people who wanted to preserve Gezi Park and register their protest to anti-vaccination activists. I mean, if you think social movements only going to the social media is only going to allow people you like to find each other, you're wrong. Everybody is going to now be able to find each other. This is an incredibly important long-term impact. We're seeing clumping of people with similar people, and that's going to have long-term social impacts. This is going to have huge governance impacts. If people can find people like each other more easily, they're going to be a different kind of public. You know, the internet public is not the same kind of public as a mass media broadcast public. There's also going to be impacts because things like what political scientists call pluralistic ignorance, when you think you're the only person, so you're kind of quiet, whereas you actually, your privately held belief is a majority. So let's say you're in this room and you're thinking, oh, she's really boring. I know it's cold out there, but I could just, you know, be getting coffee somewhere. But you're unlikely to get out, you know, from the middle of the room and, you know, walk out in the middle of this, right? It's kind of rude. Don't. But let's say, you know, there was a way you could all talk to each other. And let's say there's a hashtag. There is, TechCTI, right? And then everybody starts saying, oh, she's really droning. And, you know, we could be getting coffee. It's a sunny day. You can see how if you all figured out, if you were all the majority, you could do things that you couldn't do as a minority. You know, everybody could just say, all right, let's just get out of here in a way that wouldn't have been possible. I think a lot of governance kind of relied on people not finding each other and not realizing what their view might have been majority, that their discomfort might have been shared by lots of people. I think that mode of governance is on the way out. If that's how you are ruling, that's not really going to work. There's also a crisis of representation in that people are completely and thoroughly disillusioned with their representatives. Do I need to explain in this town why that might be the case? You know, sorry about that. But this crisis of representation in a lot of times is being reflected by people using social media to get out of trying to deal with questions of representation, delegation, negotiation. People are learning to do things without necessarily having to negotiate, without having to figure out representation, because they can just organize around one goal and try to do that. But as we know, once again, in this town, negotiation makes a lot of things happen. And increasingly, you're having movements and people and parties come to power without having gone through those steps, partly because, U.S. example, people are running and winning primaries without having to build the fundraising network that would have been, or having to rely on the party insiders, and then they come in as outsiders, and then you see how that plays out in governance. So I think there are these huge long-term impacts. I'm not going to say, I mean, recently, my last year's motto is the internet good or bad? Yes. I mean, I can't really tell you which one of these things is good, because it's not your pony. It's not just going to do what you like. But what it's going to do is homophily, leaderless movements, movements that don't deal with representation, pluralistic ignorance, or, you know, this kind of things just not working anymore, censorship not working. It's going to do a lot of those things at the same time. What worries me is that sort of people in power seem to be looking at this as a question of how do we maintain and how do we sort of control and moderate these things that are erupting without dealing with the sources of the eruption. So we have this dual crisis in which the people who are kind of erupting in little movements here and there don't really know how to organize for a certain kind of governance impact. And a lot of the governance people are like, okay, how do we survive this crisis? And that way we're not solving the problems that is generating these tensions to begin with.
So we've talked a little bit about how the activists are learning and adapting, but what about how governments are learning and adapting? I mean, you're saying you don't think censorship works anymore. There's an alternative interpretation that actually governments are learning how to censor. That in Iran, for example, when the election protests emerged a couple years ago, the government figured out social media and mobile devices are great because protesters leave digital fingerprints. It's much easier to catch people. It's much easier to watch and track and deal with them. So could each of you just talk briefly about the government response on in terms of technology, how they're using social media, and so on, and then we're going to open the floor to questions from the audience.
My short opinion about this is I think the government's the first instinct, how the governments react on, say, social media is how could we manipulate the social media in a, probably in a soft way. This is what we see all over. This also, we saw also in Istanbul, by the way, there was a recent article, or in Turkey, there was a recent article in one of the newspapers that if you trace back the Twitter news, in most of those big debates, they can come to 9 or 10 main sources. And this is the first reaction how the establishment, rather than talking about governments, I would love to say establishment. This is the way how the establishment reacts towards social media. They try to manipulate. That was the case in Iran. That was the case in China. And probably you know much more examples like this. But I don't think that they realize, they are able to realize that the people using social media, there's much more faster of being able to adapt themselves to the changes. If they get the feeling that they are manipulated, they will find more innovative ways to use social media. If not social media, then the next tool in line after the social media to use them more effectively. So the established people or institutions, they will be always a step behind. Now for the time being, the tendency is towards manipulation, in my opinion.
Zena?
So, obviously, yes, these digital footprints are very tempting to governments, including our own. I used to work at UMBC, so I drove by Fort Meade a lot. So, hi, guys. we know that, you know, surveillance is very tempting. And we know that censorship and selective propaganda is very often, you know, as he said, this is very often the case. So does this give governments more control or not? I think it really complicates life for them, even if they have perfect surveillance. Now, let's just sort of go with Iran and China are probably two most successful examples. Now, there's a couple of studies out by Gary King and his colleagues. Gary King is at Harvard political scientist. They've really innovative studies. They looked at what gets censored on Chinese internet. China has Weibo, which is a version of Twitter. And they have more people on Weibo than there are people in the United States, right? So it's very widely used. There's like, you know, hundreds of millions of people. It's not the case. If you're under the impression that in Chinese internet people don't complain about the government, corruption, everything they do, all the time. And it's not even censored. There's a couple of things that seem to be censored. And they looked at which got deleted by the censors. The first thing that always gets censored is if you complain about the censors. They're very touchy. Those all get deleted. You can call the Chinese Communist Party whatever you want as long as you don't mention the censors. No. But you can also complain about corruption. You can also complain about politics. The only thing that they draw the line is collective action. So if you try to organize collective action, you will get censored. You might get targeted. I haven't done a formal study in Iran, but that is my impression of what's happening in Iran, too. So surveillance. I mean, in Turkey, if you want to buy a phone, you have to give your citizen ID number for your SIM card. And it's therefore probably the government may well easily have a list of every person who visited Gezi during the height of the protests. They might have like every single person's name. They might have had it for, you know, Tahrir. It's not that hard. But I'm thinking, what do you do with a million people? What do you do with a list of million people that are opposing you? So surveillance is very powerful if you're targeting a minority. But surveillance is not as powerful if you're targeting large numbers of people and if you're facing a crisis of legitimacy. So what's happened in Iran, for example, increasingly is that they're using social media as a means of participation. You complain about the corrupt local bureaucrat and the central government acts. So it's almost like a petition to the emperor from Chinese history. You go on social media and you make yourself heard. So it's not governance participation through voting, but it's a form of participation. China today is more democratic in some ways, in particular ways of participation because of social media, even though there's a lot of surveillance as well. So it's a complicated fact. You know, if you were targeting, like in Sudan, there were activists using social media. They called for a protest on Facebook. 20 people showed up. They all got arrested. You know, if you're 20 people, this is really bad for you. Then, you know, you should just get off the internet. If there's a million of you, then it's even an analytic problem. I've argued the same with NSA, too. I mean, they're apparently vacuuming up the internet pretty successfully. Right, but what do you do with, you know, hundreds of millions of data points? You know, network analysis can only get you so far. This kind of, if you have a million people's names, it's the worst problem than having, you know, 5,000 targeted names in terms of what you're trying to do. So I'm not really thinking that governments can just rely on their surveillance capacity, which is greatly increased, as a means of control. They could, in the case of China, maybe use it to empower themselves, empower their legitimacy, so they're seen as more legitimate by listening to people. That's one thing they could do. And in the case of Iran, it's really funny. I mean, after the latest round of talks, well, one, we learned that, you know, 5+1+ Iran made a deal on social media. And then Iranian foreign minister said, we have a deal. He tweeted it out a couple seconds after we first heard it. Then Iranian president favorited his foreign minister's tweet saying we made a deal. So that's probably how he learned it too. You know, the president of Iran favorited his tweet. And I'm just watching all of this. And then Iranians flocked to the foreign minister's, Zarif's Facebook page to congratulate him. Now this is happening in a country Facebook is not legal, right? And as far as I know, there's about 17 million Facebook users in Iran. So much for not legal, right? You know, when you have 17 million people, you can't arrest them all. So if you don't solve your crisis of governance, I don't think surveillance is going to create as the same things people sometimes think it is. But it also does mean if you're a minority and you can be targeted, then you will be targeted. So I'm trying, again, is the internet good or bad? Yes, you know, that's kind of my take on the whole thing again.
Okay, great answer. Let's open the floor to questions and comments. We have a question over here. There's someone with the microphone coming up to you. If you could give us your name and your organization, please.
Okay, my name is Joe Freeman, and I used to have several organizations, but at the moment I don't have any. However, I have published several books on social movements of the 60s and 70s, and as I in the days when we used telephones and mimeograph machines. And as I have both watched and the 21st century social movements and listened to people talk about them, I find myself wondering if the internet has really made things qualitatively different or if it's just speeded things up. Because we did have the boom and bust cycle, but it took a little longer. We had all sorts of other things I've heard you talk about, but they just didn't happen quite that fast. So that would appreciate your insight into that. Has it made it really different, or has it just speeded things up?
Okay, great question. What do you think?
Okay. My very short answer would be it made the world much more different, in my opinion, for the very simple reason that until now the media was always one-sided. There was the source of the news or the comments, and now through internet or to social medias, there is a two-way communication system where you find immediately the reaction from all of the stakeholders every single moment, seamless, almost seamless. And that needs a lot of that changes a lot of dynamics in general, in my opinion.
Well, I'm going to agree and disagree a little bit. I mean, I do agree that a lot of the some of it we're seeing is not, it predates the internet, you know, the sort of a leaderless movement. You know, you want to go to 68, you have similar dynamics. That's very true. But on the other hand, I do think, and I'm sort of thinking through this, you know, as it's happening, you know, analyzing history in real time, I do think there are some qualitative differences. An NYU professor, Jay Rosen, likes to use the phrase, the people formerly known as the audience. There is no more audience, per se. Mm-hmm. I mean, the level of, you know, what he just said, I see this with young people all the time. They really don't understand this kind of one-way communication ethos. And I've increasingly found myself, I can literally not watch television unless I have a second screen up. I want to talk about it. I mean, in fact, in the media industry, ironically, this is making people go back to watching things live because, I mean, I watched the last season of Lost live, even though it had become such an awful show by that point, but it was so much fun to make fun of it. It was just hilarious to be able to talk with my friends through these incredibly bad episodes. And I think increasingly, like, my students are not used to this world in which I just talk to them and they can't talk back or participate or talk with each other. And in a class, I just thought, we were talking about what to do with final papers, and they said, of course, we're going to put it in the forum so we can see each other's papers, right? And I said, if you don't mind, of course. I mean, when I was in college, the idea that I would want all my classmates to see all my papers, I would have been like, no, can I just, like, hide it in an envelope and then, you know, in three envelopes and give it to the professor and nobody ever see it again? Whereas they've gotten used to the world where they want to see each other's papers and they want to comment on each other, and they're used to growing up public. My graduate students are like that. They want to blog. They want to, you know, talk about work in progress. They leave comments. They tweet at me. I mean, there's all these things that is going on, and I really don't see how this can't have an impact on how people conceive of themselves as subjects in this world in which they're also always able to talk to each other and talk back. How this is going to play out, I mean, I'm as curious as anybody else.
Okay, other questions? Young man over here.
Hi, my name is Joseph Mosman with APCO Worldwide. We've talked a little bit about how social media is being used or can be used for protest movements, but also for governments to use as a control and moderation mechanism. I wonder if we can turn that around a little bit and have you guys speak a little bit about how government can use it to improve the quality of its services, how it can use it to be better at the things that it wants to do and that citizens overall are in favor of.
Go ahead. You guys can
go ahead.
Okay. So I do want to say, like, in the case of Turkey, the e-governance is very, very good. It's really, compared to a lot of places in the world, the last 10 years, they've had a major step forward. It used to be that if you wanted to, and my personal example is, if you wanted to pay a little tax or something, it spent the whole day in bureaucracies, whereas right now you log on to an online portal and everything's there, and it's just super easy. In fact, the Turkey Informatics Organization, which Faruk is head of, gives awards sort of to the public sector that improves governance. So it's absolutely possible to use it to perform services better, but it does require a different way of doing things. If you haven't read it, I really recommend Clay Shirky's blog, where he just posted on why healthcare.gov is what it is. You can't do it the way, I mean, it's not just the procurement issue. Clearly, that's part of the big problem. That's clearly what happened in that case. But developing technology for service is not the same as delivering any other kind of widget. It requires a different way of interacting. So that's one part. The other thing I do want to say is that people have thought. There was this movement in, it's called ICT for Development, ICT4D. People thought that we could convince governments to provide better services through technology, and then that will make them more transparent and more accountable. You know, there's a lot of sort of let's get governments. That doesn't seem to work either, you know, because a lot of these technological capacities that governments can use to provide services are also very strong tools of surveillance, that, as you talked about, because if you're providing these services, you also have a lot more surveillance capacity. So how they impact government moderation or entrenchment, I think, is quite complicated, but the potential is definitely there. But it requires a mindset. It requires a different kind of mindset. It's not, you can't just throw money at it. You can burn a lot of money and not get anything done if you don't change the mindset of how you're organizing governance, I believe.
Yeah. I can only give some examples of, about Turkey. And not only about, social media. I would also use examples, let's say, from machine-to-machine operation. I mean, what is important is to get as fast information back from whatever, from the people, from the institutions, or from anywhere to the government directly. And I know there are some very nice projects, but they are all in a very in the toddler phase yet. My favorite example is that, as Zeynep has mentioned, we gave a prize a couple of years ago to that particular project, that in Turkey we don't see too many, let's say, forest fires. And the reason for that is immediately the Ministry for Foresting made such a good project about early warning systems. Immediately when a feedback comes about a forest fire, a small trickle of forest fire, immediately the system activates itself, and it will be eradicated. And compared to the forest fires in the neighboring countries, in Greece, in Russia or in other Middle East countries, the forest fires almost completely diminished in Turkey. This year there were a couple of cases, but that was very small compared with the other years, compared with the last 5 years, for instance.
Other questions? Standing in the very back.
Hi there. Brooke, a question. Do you feel like you had made a comparison between door-to-door canvassing and use of social media for petition drives? I'm sorry, Charles Ellison with the Philadelphia Tribune. You had made that comparison. So do you feel like heavy reliance or heavy use of social media diminishes young people's or the millennial generation's, I don't know what we want to call them or sort of classify them as right now, diminishes their understanding of civics, of how the process really works, you know, basically using the social media, using Twitter to try to influence decision-making on Capitol Hill, that's all fine and dandy, but they don't understand you. I think either one of you had mentioned how important negotiation is. So do you feel like that understanding of civics of the process is diminished, and how bad is that, or how negative is that?
Well, I'm trying to like sort of not say it's complicated, but I can't escape it. Sorry, I'm going to say it's complicated. Now, I do want to say that I don't mean that social media, I mean, the way this works usually is that these people aren't using it. I mean, a lot of people think that, oh, they're doing things online but not offline. That's not the case. It's all online and offline. I mean, the way the young generation uses these tools is they also use it to talk to the same people offline and they talk to the online. So they don't have this divide in their sort of minds about online, offline. They're using both to talk to their friends. The example I gave was more from NGOs who thought, oh, let's do petitions online. It doesn't work the same way if you're an institution. Because if you're an institution and you're doing petitions, the door-to-door process brings some other goods to the table that the online process does not necessarily bring. So in terms of the civics, I have to say that I think the more broken part of civics is not the young people's perception of it, but the actual practice of civics by the establishment. I think there's this sort of disconnect. So I don't want to say the young people don't know how to do civics well, because what's their example? I mean, it's not like there's a great path forward for them that we have put forth. So, but what is happening, I believe, is that lacking sort of this institutional way or an example of how to get change done civically around them, and this is the U.S., this is Europe, this is Egypt, this is Turkey, so there's this young people who are frustrated. We're facing this crisis. We're not giving them, you know, there's not a lot of engagement tools for them to engage in civics. So they are trying. A lot of things people dismiss as slacktivism or collectivism, I think, are actually the deepest impacts. I think a lot of people are just dismissing these things and saying, oh, they're just clicking on like on Facebook. It doesn't matter. I think long term, ironically, I think that may matter more than many other impacts of social media, because, I mean, look at the example of Kony 2012, which a lot of problems, but 100 million people saw it, this video about Ugandan warlord, long, complicated story. But every one of my students knows about it, and a lot of them got involved, and they wanted to do something because they felt like this is a world that I can care about something more than myself. You talk to the kids in Occupy, this is the same thing. They want to do something that's not just about themselves. They want to engage civics. They're trying. But there aren't many paths open. So they end up talking to each other, and it ends up getting, you know, sort of this turbulence that doesn't really direct itself somewhere. And I would like to say that I don't want to blame them for wanting to engage and not finding a path and using social media this way. And just to give sort of very short example, look at the gay marriage debate in this country. It went from, in 10 years, from this majority against. So now it's just a matter of time, because if you look at the poll numbers, if you look among young people, it's a done deal, right? You know, 80% for those crazy numbers. And a lot of that partially happened because if you go on Facebook and you're in high school, you're going to see people, Facebook lets you declare your sexual orientation. They've all grown up knowing people who are open about it. They've all grown up with seeing this, you know, online, offline all the time. So you can see how things that look really unimportant, like what's the point of, you know, seeing something symbolically? Well, it makes a huge difference 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the line. So that's a, you see, I'm trying to get at the complexity of it without saying, oh, the kids these days, they don't know how to do canvassing. I don't want to say that.
Other questions? Right here, we have a question.
Thank you. I'm Dean Jackson with the National Endowment for Democracy. I had a question on censorship. You said that censorship may or may not be getting harder, but one thing we've noticed is that as opposed to traditional censorship where the government limits what can be said, some governments are now experimenting with ways to participate. And so you see things in China like the 50 Cent Army, or in Russia there have been reports that the government there will set up Facebook polls in which automated bots will participate to give the illusion of legitimacy. And I was wondering, in this kind of new world we're discussing, will people see through this, or will this have an impact on shaping the online discourse or the ability of people to mobilize and express dissent online? I was just curious as to what you guys thought about that.
This is again for you. Go ahead. Shoot.
Well, it's a prey-predator game. Right? You know, we see this in Bahrain, for example. The internet is useless. If you say anything about Bahrain and use the hashtag, you know, especially if it's during work hours, 9 to 5 in Bahrain, you get flooded with, you'd say, trolls. And it usually ends after the workday ends, so surprise, you know, it's their employees a lot of the times. So governments can do those things, but I want to say legitimacy is legitimacy. Right. If you're not, if you're weak, if you've got the sort of weak legitimacy problem, sooner or later, your automated censorship is not going to catch it. So, in the case of, you know, that sooner or later, you might be able to deflect once, you might be able to deflect twice, you might escape one crisis, but these tools are not easily automatable, that censorship. If in China there is not a mass movement that is mostly and partly in, you know, some degree because the Chinese people do see their government as legitimate. They may have gripes. They may have problems. Of course, they probably all want to be freer. But, I mean, look at what China's done. In 2 decades, they have, you know, moved half the country from dire poverty. You know, they've industrialized. They've become a world power. It's not really surprising to me. If you look at Russia, the case of Russia, I mean, you had this post-Soviet crazy collapse. If you look at the numbers, you know, shortened life expectancy, you see this enormous, I mean, compared to the depth of the crisis, worse than anything we've experienced. And now, partly thanks to the strong autocratic government and partly price of oil, things aren't as bad. So I don't think that if the Chinese people and the Russian people, if the government really faced a crisis of legitimacy, it would just be a matter of time before they would either unplug the internet or can't keep up. You know, in China, when people do want to talk about something online, we see censorship doesn't terribly work. They use different symbols. They get around it. They, you know, they come up with the clever workaround. And in the case of, I mean, look at the case of Egypt. I was interviewing one of the activists about, you know, when they thought what was happening. If you remember, there was a day in which the Egyptian government decided to use camels and horses, thugs and camels and horses, to charge the protesters. This was like made global news. So this activist I was interviewing told me that when he saw the camels and horses charging towards the protester in Tahrir, he said, "I started laughing." And I said, "Okay, I guess, you know, by that time you were really lacking sleep and maybe I," you know, he said, no. He said, "I knew we won." I said, "Well, how did that work, really? You know, people on thugs on camels charging towards you." He said that they had gotten satellite phones, which work everywhere. There's, you know, they had made, they were giving live interviews to BBC using smuggled satellite phones to CNN. They had basically captured the global narrative, right? This is when internet is unplugged. This is when, you know, so you have all this massive censorship, and yet the activists are, you know, giving live interviews to CNN and BBC. And what does the government come up with against these 21st century kids? Camels? I mean, it's not even 17th century, right? It's not really very good. So that wasn't going to work. You know? So I think it works to a degree, but it doesn't terribly work. If you want to say, well, what about Egypt now? That's the current government in Egypt, it's polarized. It does have internal support. Whatever else it might be, it has a lot of opposition and it has internal support. So if you have some level of support within the country, and if it's a polarized country, maybe you can get away with lots of things, but not if there's widespread crisis of legit. That's my view of how this operates in the long term. And I'm trying to think of a case in which censorship fully worked, and I don't terribly see it as such.
Here on the aisle, there's a question.
I'm Peter Nye. I'm not affiliated with any organization. I'm here independently. To what, if any, extent do you think that social media is decreasing the appeal of a party system, especially a two-party system? And I ask because my understanding has always been that one of the primary purposes of a party system is to compensate for the lack of information and the difficulty of communication and organization. So what if social media is making it easier and easier for people to work outside of the context of a political party, and to the extent that that's the case, what do you think the party system is going to be replaced by?
Party system, iki parti sistemi dışında sosyal medyadan organize olmayabiliyorlar. Parti sistemi çökecek mi partiler? Siyasi partiler.
Sen söyleyince ben devam edeyim.
I think it's lessening the appeal of all institutional politics because, but again, it's not because the institutional politics are not seen as responsive. And I think that's the problem, is that they're not seen as responsive, not necessarily. And now there's a tool that you can get around them.
I think that's the answer for such a question is a bit too early, in my opinion. But I see, at least in our case, that, I mean, the system, the major party system, which is also in effect in Europe or in Turkey or here in the States, will be replaced in the next future much more by representative voices in general. And this doesn't go too much in parallel with the big parties or two-party systems in general, what we are living through right now. I mean, for instance, in Turkey and in Europe, you see, at least I see the frustration of the people on which side they are, they really don't know. Are they social democrats? Are they left-wing? Right-wing, are they humanist, or what are they? And this diversification, in my opinion, will continue to grow in the next future. And there will be a multi-voice system replacing what's going on right now in a two or three big party system.
This gentleman here has a question. There's a microphone coming up for you.
Hi, good morning. My name is Bernie Lubrin, and I'm with a digital customer experience analytics company. But this isn't about analytics. I'm interested, particularly in Turkey, if you could talk about how the Islamic society is dealing with social media and maybe even beyond Turkey into other countries, because everything you're talking about seems to be a secularist trend. But please, enlighten us.
I don't think that has too much to do with the Islamic system or the secular system. It's more being let's say, progressiveness and conservativeness. This is a big difference. I think there's a huge difference between it. And here in Turkey, we observed there were also quite fundamentalist progressive groups involved in the Gezi issue, in the Taksim issue. But I think more important is the innovative and the productive and the progressive groups, which is much more globalized in a way which has much more common denominator with other countries, with not only with its in the Middle Eastern or Near East neighbors all over the world. This was a reaction of a global progressive young generation. Of course, there were also other forces which went into coalition with them. Also, the radical laicistic systems, but in general, they were more the progressive forces against more authoritarian, conservative establishment. And I don't think that there is too much of a parallel between Islamic or fundamentalistic or semi-fundamentalistic versus laicistic system.
Well, there were Islamist groups in Gezi. They participated there on social media. And also a lot of young people who are, you know, I would say supporters of the AKP, the Islamist political party in Turkey, they're all on social media. It's really, I mean, it's not that divided. I want to give you an example from, I went to Doha for a forum right after Egypt and Tunisian sort of uprising revolutions had succeeded and before the Syrian civil war had started and before the Libyan intervention had started. And it had, the forum had young activists from all over the sort of the region, right, Middle East and North Africa, and things hadn't gotten awful yet, so they were really like, yay, you know, there was just this incredible sense of, look what we did. But the forum also invited many, many, many luminaries from opposition parties across the region, and some of those luminaries were Islamists, where, you know, in case of Egypt, you know, Muslim Brotherhood had opposed this regime for a long time, so some of them were from there. Of course, it's Qatar, so they were sympathetic to that. Some of them were secular. So I sat in the back with the young activists. I was sort of more interested in them. Whoever came on, Islamists, you know, they had a sort of an auditorium like this, and the forum was organized the old way. A couple of people came up. They went blah, 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 blah. They didn't really take questions. There wasn't a hashtag. There wasn't back and forth. The kids in the back, they all were like, they just constantly rolled their eyes. And an Islamist guy got up, total heroes in some way, right? 40 years in Mubarak's prison, you know, every credential you want in terms of being opposition, they rolled their eyes. They saw them as establishment. A secular person came up, same story, you know, some other autocrats, prison, 40 years, whatever, the kids in the back, who were a mix of, you know, sort of new ideologies. It doesn't really totally fit. Some of them do identify as Islamists, some don't, but it's a mix. They constantly rolled their eyes, and I call it twickled them, like heckled them on Twitter, saying, we want to talk too. So it was a really exactly what he was saying. It was this establishment versus, you know, they were like, it's our time, we want to do something. And I have seen this. You know, I was in a protest in, I was observing a protest in Tahrir when a Salafi, like really sort of very, very, very conservative Wahhabi Salafi group came up with a banner and they had a hashtag on it. So I went up and, you know, it was like, what the heck is going on? And they had said, Salafi Costa. I'm like, what is this? What's going on? It's a coffee shop in Egypt. And they had changed the name to Salafi. I'm like, why? They said, well, we get blamed for everything by all these secular kids. So we're just saying, oh, the coffee's on us. You know, just give us the bill because it's always our fault. We're going to pay for everything. So the coffee's on us. So they were joking about this. And then I'm like, I thought this was funny. And then, you know, I talked to them. And then I came back and they were trying to Facebook friend me. And, you know, this is as conservative a bunch as you'll get. And I asked them, what about your, you know, elders? What about, you know, sort of, what do they think of this? They're like, oh, they're all the same. You know, as far as they're concerned, they wanted all the old establishment to go away. Those kids with their, you know, foot-long beards and all of that felt a little more at home with these secular kids who were, I mean, yes, there's differences. I don't want to say they're all the same, but there's really this new thing coming in which they kind of, they want to participate. They want to shape their future. They want to talk to each other in ways I think both establishments don't necessarily understand. In Gezi, I observed Islam is very strong, you know, very pious people. Interact with both online and offline with kids with dreadlocks, chatting. They know the same internet memes. They have the same jokes. I'm not going to say they're going to agree on everything, but there's a way in which it's not the real divide, I think, that's going on. So I'm going to really agree with what he said.
Okay, we have time for one more question, so we'll take this one right here. There's a microphone coming over to you.
Hello, Arvind. My name is Haitao. I come from Sina, the Chinese internet brand. And the other day, I read a book about New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and he talked about the relationship between social media and city governance, and he expressed a lot of concern about that. He said, not like before, nowadays, when he wants to conduct some reform, actually a lot of opinions show up on the social media, and it's not very irrational. Actually, it's kind of a slow down the correct reform. So he expressed a lot of negativity about the social media. So do you or do you not agree with that? Thank you.
Belediye başkanı sosyal medyadan şikayet ediyor. Reform yapacağım, şikayet ediyorlar, yapamıyorum diye.
We're doing Turkish translation up here.
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, well, look, I mean, well, yes and no. As I said, it's going to bring together, if you've got people who are against what you're doing in some way, you just can't do things the old way. The other day, JP Morgan decided to have a Twitter chat, promoted a hashtag. Didn't go too well because people started asking tough questions. A year ago, McDonald's wanted to have Mickey D stories and promoted Mickey D stories as a way of, tell us your McDonald's stories. Well, a lot of people had McDonald's stories that McDonald's didn't necessarily want them telling, and McDonald's ended up paying for people, you know, promoting their dislike of all the things. So it's no longer a world in which it can be a mayor or a government or anything and expect it to work the way television worked, where McDonald's would go buy an ad where it would tell its Mickey D story, and that would be that. You can no longer tell your Mickey D story the way you want. Is this always good? No, because if you're trying to say vaccination is good and the anti-vaccination crowd can come together and tell their story, there's no rule that says only rational or good stories are going to come together and come at you. But they're going to come at you. I mean, there's just no getting around this. Sometimes we celebrate, you know, the ones we like, kids in Tahrir, yay. And then we see anti-vaccination people, we go, boo. It's the same dynamic. So you can complain about it. And I'm not going to say it's whatever he was trying to do. It's regardless of what I think of it. I don't think governance can work the same way. The audience is no more an audience. This is not television. It's not coming back. And you know, it's life.
Okay, we're out of time, but I want to thank Farouk and Zainab for sharing your views with us, and it was very informative. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for great questions, too.